You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
Hello.
How's everyone doing this evening?
Super.
Pretty good.
Well. Guess what today is?
It is 100 years after the Titanic struck an iceberg.
Steve, why you gotta step all over my stuff?
Because you asked.
It was a rhetorical question, Steve.
Oh, I don't know, Rebecca. What is today?
Today is the 100th anniversary of the Titanic sinking. You see how I said it even better than you did?
Except you were wrong.
Shut up.
The Titanic did not sink on the 14th. It struck the iceberg at 11:40 on the 14th.
Ah.
It sunk on the 15th.
I was going by Australian time, Steve.
But not local ship time. I'm going by local ship time.
No.
Local shipwreck time.
I was trying to be kind to our Australian friends.
Mm-hmm. Now you said it hit a Goldberg? What? Oh, an iceberg.
An iceberg, right. Tell us the story.
You know the story, Steve. You know the story. Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet got on a boat. The boat sank. One of them died, I guess. I didn't make it to the end. Really long movie. Yes, in 1912, the Titanic was the hot ticket, supposedly unsinkable liner, and they were wrong. They hit an iceberg and sunk. There were not enough lifeboats to go around. Lots of people died. We talked about this last week, I believe.
We did. A lot of interesting details about the story. As I said last week, 1,514 people died. There were only enough lifeboats on the Titanic for half of the current passengers, only a third of maximal capacity.
Yeah, they didn't even fill those boats. Like, some of them launched with a dozen people.
Yeah, that was...
Because it was a big...
It was poor training. The crew didn't know how many people were supposed to go in the boat, so they were launching them half full. Yeah, it was crazy.
Oof.
And most of the men died. They did women and children first. Most of the men, even first class, 67%, two-thirds of men in first class died. Most people who died from hypothermia. As soon as they hit the water, they lasted a minute. I mean, they died almost immediately.
Down.
Yeah. Were you guys aware that there was a ship that could have rescued everybody? The SS Californian was very close at hand, had spotted the Titanic, had spotted the flares, the rockets that were launched. Mm-hmm. The captain who was asleep, Captain Stanley Lord, he was awakened by a junior officer, and he basically was like, all right, whatever. He rolled over, went back to sleep. He basically said, what colors were they? Were they like just trying to identify themselves or something? I guess the ships would use different colored flares as an ID. He said, nope, all the flares were white, Captain. It's like, all right, keep me posted. Yeah, but they basically didn't do anything. They could. They arrived at 5 o'clock in the morning after the Carpathia had already rescued everybody who was in the lifeboats. It was too late to be of any use. So it was really a tragedy. I mean, just no idea.
Oh my God! It's even worse.
On. Yeah.
Could you imagine that guy a week later?
Yeah, that's
like he must have. It probably ruined his life.
Oh, it did. I mean, he was actually. An inquiry found that he acted improperly, so probably his career was over at that point.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but good. I mean, it should ruin his life.
It should.
He ruined the lives of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I agree.
Wow. Hey, guys, I went through a website that was just talking about the common myths of the Titanic, and one that surprised me was that this whole idea of the ship being unsinkable, according to this website anyway, they said that the company that made the ship didn't really promote hardly at all this idea of it being unsinkable, and it seems to be a myth that was created after the sinking. And if you looked, you really won't be able to find too much that said, hey, it's unsinkable before it actually sank. But after it sank, that's when that whole idea just kind of like really exploded. And which I thought was really,
I never heard
of
that. That is interesting.
If that is true, I never heard of it either.
It's not odd. That makes perfect sense. It's exactly what happens. People change stories
to
make them more profound. How many times have you heard someone said, oh, the doctor said I would never walk, and here I am walking? You know what? Right. No doctor ever said that. Sure. You made that up after you rehab and you were able to walk again. So it's the same. I totally believe that because I see that happen all the time in other contexts. But that is interesting because I'd never heard that before about the Titanic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised either. It just surprised me that after a century, I would guess most people have no idea about that if it's true. This was just based on one website that I read.
Titanic had a sister ship, the Olympic.
There were two other ships in that class.
Mm-hmm. Britannia was one. As another one. Actually, this website had another interesting little tidbit. There wasn't much recorded footage of the Titanic because what was the first one that had this maiden voyage previously? Was it the
Olympic was in service in 1911? And it's Britannic, not Britannia.
So the Olympic had its maiden voyage previously, and the captain of the Titanic was also the captain of that ship, and they went and they sailed the same exact route, by the way. So the fanfare wasn't, you know, it just wasn't as special of an event because it had already happened. And some of the footage that you may see for the Titanic was actually not the Titanic; it was one of its sister ships because there wasn't a lot of footage of the Titanic because it was just kind of like. Almost a ho-hum, like, okay, here we go again type thing.
That reminds me of one of the other problems that people who really love the whole Titanic thing, one of the problems they face is that it's difficult to get any kind of souvenir that has the word Titanic on it because most of the things on the ship just said White Star Line because it
White
was
Star Line.
One of several, you know, basically identical liners.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's interesting.
The Britannic was sunk by a mine during World War I.
A mine!
1916. But the Olympic lasted quite a while, and it was retired out of service in 1935, so it was the only one to not see a disastrous end.
Well, happy 100th
sink day.
I thought the movie sucked.
I know I'm in the minority, did not like the movie.
No, it was an awful movie. Are you kidding?
I saw Kate Winslet in an interview recently about the movie, and it made me very happy when she said, whenever she hears the Celine Dion song, her eyes roll, and like in her mind, she's thinking, wow, I really can't stand this song at all.
Yeah, I love her. Kate Winslet's awesome.
All right, well, let's move on to the next item. Bob, there is yet another crazy scheme to deal with this whole space junk hubbub.
Yeah, resident space objects have been in the news lately. Have you ever heard of those? That's a euphemism I came across for the common old space junk. I think NASA uses that term. Specifically, NASA is seriously considering a new way to get rid of our dangerous orbiting debris. The idea is to literally blow up some of the Earth's atmosphere so it goes into space and causes some of the space junk that's there to deorbit and burn up in our atmosphere. When I first saw that, I was like, well, you got to be kidding, right? But actually, the more I read, the more interesting it became. And this is a really cool idea for many reasons. Just first, though, just a quick primer on space junk. Space junk consists primarily of spent rocket stages and dead satellites and collision debris, et cetera, and all that. There's quite a bit of it out there. About 22,000 pieces as large as a softball or bigger. There's 500,000 pieces approximately bigger than a marble. And if you count everything greater than a millimeter, you're talking literally hundreds of millions of items just careening around at orbital velocities. And the tiny ones can pack a punch. You think, oh, you know, it's smaller than a millimeter, big deal. But these high orbital velocities, though, really give it tremendous kinetic energy. For example, a marble traveling at 22,000 miles per hour has the kinetic energy of a 400-pound safe dropped from 100 feet.
That would crush a rabbit. A wascally rabbit, particularly.
You know, but what really scares me, though, the most, many people believe that we've already passed what's called this critical threshold. It's possible that now or sometime in the near future, that even if we do nothing from this moment on, the junk will multiply, causing a cascade as it hits itself, making more little pieces, which then hit other pieces, et cetera, until it gets so bad that nothing could survive a journey in space. Can you imagine that?
I predict if we completely ignore this problem, it will just go away.
Yeah, just wait a bunch of centuries and
close your eyes.
You're all set. Did you guys know that the International Space Station recently had a really close call? A real close call with the space junk?
How close?
Well, the astronauts were bored. Imagine you're an astronaut on the ISS and you get a call. And they're like, guys, you know, could you go into the closest Russian Soyuz spacecraft and just wait for further instructions? Okay, guys? that's what they were told. Sure. What is scary?
Bob? Give me 1 minute.
When was this?
A week ago? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, just past month. The other scary part is that no one knew about this potentially imminent collision until it was too late to move the ISS. They actually can and have moved the entire space station out of the way, but there was like not enough time because they do need a lot of hours to actually, you know, get this thing moving. It turned out that a piece of a disabled Russian rocket was bearing down on them at 17,000 miles per hour. Luckily, it missed them by 7 miles, which may seem like a lot, but it really isn't when you're in orbit. But last June, a piece missed them by, get this, 1,000 feet.
Oh, that's close.
1,000 feet, which
that's
is nothing. That's a bullet grazing your forehead.
That's eerily, by the way, similar to the Titanic. They saw the iceberg a long time before they hit it, but it just takes so long to turn that ship around.
Oh,
they just couldn't turn it around fast enough, and they scraped past it.
Bob, they shoot these things with lasers. What do they do?
No. Actually, that is possible, and China actually tested that a bunch of years ago, and they have, of course, created lots of debris. Really pissed me off. But, you know, you may think, clean it all. Yeah, right. It's kind of easy to think, well, just clean it all up, right? Just go gather it. But physics and economics kind of giggles at you a bit when you say that. General William Shelton is the head of the Air Force Space Command. What an awesome title that is. He's very pessimistic. He recently said, there's no solution. Just don't generate new debris.
There's no solution.
He said, if you look at the problem of trying to clean up debris, the physics just don't close. Now, that's a direct quote. I get his gist, but his phrasing seems kind of awkward.
Just not halfway.
He finished with what we know about propulsion, there's no way to get there. So
NASA's going to blow up the atmosphere.
Yeah, right. But if you look at the ideas that have been posited in the past, generally it involves a ship going from satellite, you know, dead satellite to dead satellite, picking them up. And it really doesn't work. It's not practical at all. I mean, you think about it. You have to change orbits and positions and velocities so often. The cost and weight to accomplish all that would be a joke. But the really important point there is that there's a lot of debris that you can't see. We can't see it. I mean, there's literally millions of things in orbit that we cannot see, and that stuff is incredibly dangerous, even if it's really tiny. You know, we can't track any of that stuff. So are you going to go and find and intercept all of them? I mean, there's no way we're going to do that, not with today's technology. Anyway, but that's where SPADE comes in. That stands for Space Debris Elimination, which has been proposed by Daniel Gregory of Raytheon BBN Technologies in Virginia. And it is an interesting idea. The idea is to somehow fire focused pulses of our atmosphere at the junk flying above it to change its trajectory, or, you know, causing it to deorbit and burn up faster. This is actually being seriously vetted by the NIAC, or NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts Project. And two ways they think they can pull this off include a high-altitude plane or balloon being used to ignite enough fuel to cause this directed explosion. And calculations show that it wouldn't even need that much fuel. Perhaps, I think the number was 500 gallons. I mean, it's not a lot to accomplish this. Daniel recently said, our preliminary results show that we can affect the orbits of low Earth orbit debris. We think we have a viable solution. And the beauty of this whole idea, I think, is threefold. It can handle all the junk in the size spectrum from the biggest to the smallest. There's really no limitation. There's also no chance of adding new debris, and that's really key. You know, you're not putting machinery into orbit to accomplish a task, so there's no chance of a mishap, like, say, an explosion, and then just adding more mass to the space junk that's already there. You know, of course, there could be, you know, it's not foolproof. You could, you know, ignite prematurely or too late and affect the orbit of something you don't want to affect. Or you could actually, I guess, change the orbit in such a way that it causes some debris to careen into some other debris. So yeah, it's not foolproof, but it's good that you're not actually putting, you know, more objects into space than you have to. And the atmosphere that gets exploded into space just settles back down into the atmosphere like nothing happened. So that's not a problem. Also, many pieces can be dealt with at once. And the thinking is that that you only need like 3% change in velocity, and that would probably be enough to deorbit most debris. Now, remember, orbital mechanics is not like flying in an atmosphere. If you're in orbit and your velocity decreases, you will enter a lower orbit. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's why the moon is moving away from us. As it steals angular momentum from the Earth, it moves faster and therefore enters into a higher orbit. It's just getting farther and farther away. So I hope this idea pans out. I'd rather not have future generations, you know, curse us because we're so messy and because we were so messy and short-sighted. And please, China and other nations, don't show off and test your lasers by blowing up satellites and creating thousands more pieces of these resident space objects. We have enough there. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks, Bob. I'm going to come down to Earth a little bit for the next item. This one is about an herbal product that's a deadly toxin. You guys ever hear of Aristolochia clematis?
No.
No.
What the hell's that?
Well, it's, yeah. They're actually, yes. The same root.
Chlamydia?
These are flowers that, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, the flower kind of looks like the exit from a womb. The birth canal.
Very, very well put.
Get what I'm saying there, Evan?
Oh, okay. There you go.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I do now. Yeah, now.
No. I think
you're really going to have to spell it out here, Steve.
Yeah, wait. Let me Google this and so I can see what you're talking about.
And this podcast, a lot of natural herbal or whatever remedies were based upon the notion that whatever the plant looks like, that's what it's used for. So this has been a traditional remedy in a lot of cultures for easing birth, you know, to use during birth. The birthing process. It was a very popular herb in traditional Chinese medicine. However, it was recently found in the 1990s. So again, used for hundreds, perhaps a couple of thousand years as an herbal remedy for lots of things. Again, birth symptoms, but also snake bites and rashes and other things. For this reason, because it has had a long traditional use, a lot of people, you know, make the naturalistic argument, well, it's natural, it's been used for thousands of years, it's got to be safe, right? Turns out, it's a deadly nephrotoxin. It will destroy your kidneys. This was first discovered in the 1990s, as I said, when there was a rash of kidney failure among young Belgian women. And it was discovered that they were all, you know, visiting the same herbalist and were getting treatment for weight loss, which included a Aristolochia species. It was found that the aristolochic acid, which is produced by some species of Aristolochia, is a nephrotoxin. Another similar case, this one in the Balkans, it was discovered that, again, there was an increase in kidney damage, and it was found that Aristolochia seeds, which is a weed that commonly grows in the wheat fields, was finding its way into the bread that was being made, so people were eating the Aristolochia seeds. Now researchers believe that these are both the same syndrome. You know, rather than having, you know, they called the first syndrome Chinese herbal nephrotoxicity and the second one Balkan nephrotoxicity. Now they're saying actually they're both just aristolochic acid nephropathy. They're both just the same entity. And a lot has been discovered about, you know, the mechanism and you know how this toxin works. Well, now there's a new study that shows in addition to causing kidney failure, the aristolochic acid also causes or increases the risk for urinary tract cancers. The researchers originally became suspicious of this because it was known that in Taiwan, there is about four times the rate of bladder and other urinary tract cancers than in the Western world. So there's a cluster, you know. And whenever there's a cluster, it always makes epidemiologists interested. You know, what is it, genetic or is it environmental? Researchers were able to find a strong correlation between Taiwanese with urinary tract cancers and mutations that are known to be caused by aristolochic acid. So it's, you know, one line of evidence that is correlating use of, again, herbal aristolochia with significant increase in cancer. Now, this is a very important story because in many countries, including the U.S., herbal remedies are not well regulated. In the U.S. in 1994, they were taken essentially away from the FDA in that the FDA no longer had to approve herbal remedies before they can go on the market, and companies could also make these pseudo, you know, structure function claims for herbs. They became regulated like supplements, as if they were vitamins. And since 1994, the FDA has only been able to pull one herbal remedy from the market, and that was ephedra. You guys remember the whole ephedra thing?
Yeah, sure do. Yeah,
about 100 people dropped dead, you know, from heart attacks because of ephedra. That's what it took. So only one case where the FDA was able to do that. So now we have an herbal product that is a known kidney toxin and can increase the risk of cancer, and the FDA cannot pull it from the market. Doesn't really have the authority to do it. It can ban its import, and it has done that, so you can't import it, but there's no ban on selling or using it once it's in the country.
Sometimes it seems as though the FDA is just completely useless.
Yeah, but like, it's not their fault. They were made that way by Congress. Their laws were passed to make them powerless.
Right. I'm not saying it's necessarily their fault. I'm just saying it's really frustrating to have something called the Food and Drug Administration that can't administrate drugs.
This is an ongoing battle. But unfortunately, the two senators, Orrin Hatch and Tom Harkin, who are behind DSHEA, the 1994 Diet Supplement Health and Education Act, they're powerful. And they keep successfully squashing initiatives to revise that law, give more authority back to the FDA. So I think as long as they're in the Senate, it's not going to happen.
And I think one of my big frustrations is with the fact that oftentimes we get into arguments with alternative medicine proponents. You know, it would be nice to have an administration that had pull and that was somehow helpful in rebutting claims of alt metters. So to say something like, well, you know, I know that you like that homeopathic treatment, but look here at the fact that the FDA has, you know, issued these warnings about it and made it illegal. And, you know, it would help us a lot. It would help our jobs a lot if we had an organization that provided real solid oversight. It would help give our arguments more heft.
Unfortunately, you know, so-called complementary and alternative medicine is one of the pseudosciences that enjoys bipartisan support. It's not one where only one party that's really behind it and the other party can criticize them for being unscientific.
Yeah.
It's really bipartisan. And as Harkin and Hatch attest, there's one Democrat, one Republican. You know, they get together and that's when problems happen, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's unfortunate. There's just no political will
to deal with this issue.
And again, the other lesson here is that, you know, herbs are drugs. People think of them as supplements or food or whatever, but that they're somehow different because they're natural. They're drugs. They have a pharmacological activity. They contain chemicals. They have drug-drug interactions. They can cause the same kind of side effects that drugs can. The only difference is we don't really know what their pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics are. We don't know how much of what active ingredients you're getting, and there's lots of hidden toxicity. This is something that was used for thousands of years, and nobody noticed that people were getting more bladder cancer. How could they really? I mean, we need to do epidemiological studies to figure out that this increases the risk of cancer. So it really isn't reasonable to expect that just because something has been used for a long time that people would have casually observed a medical or a health risk from that substance. But that's what we're left with now. So really we're in a situation where the consumer has to be savvy and has to be aware, which is why it's important for these stories to get play. But let's move on. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about some new research into homophobia.
Yes. Okay. Quick quiz for you guys. What do these people have in common? Ted Haggard, Bishop Eddie Long, Congressman Larry Craig, New Jersey Mayor Chris Myers, and Chris Cooper in American Beauty. Go.
Vowels in their names.
Good guess.
They're all skeptics.
No. You guys are not good at this game. The answer is they are all severely homophobic people who, it later turns out, displayed allegedly homosexual behaviors. Ted Haggard, for instance, preached against same-sex marriage to his megachurch and was later found to be engaging in homosexual sex, sexy homosexual sex with a meth dealer. So, you know, this is something that has become a cliche in our culture. It's the virulently homophobic jerk who turns out to secretly be harboring homosexual urges. Finally, there has been a study to determine whether or not there is any truth to the cliche. The Journal of Personality and Social Psychology has just published a paper called Parental Autonomy Support and Discrepancies Between Implicit and Explicit Sexual Identities, Dynamics of Self-Acceptance and Defense. They really know how to make a juicy study sound boring, by the way, those psychologists. In the study, there were four different experiments done on college kids in Germany and the U.S. In the first experiment, students gave their stated sexual orientation, and then the students were primed subliminally with either the word me or the word others. They were then shown pictures of straight and gay couples. Those who associated me with gay, they were shown pictures of straight and gay couples, and then they were asked to categorize them as straight or gay. So those who associated the word me with gay quickly and me with straight slowly were considered to have implicitly gay desires. In the second experiment, subjects were allowed to browse same-sex or opposite-sex photos, and they were apparently then judged. In the third experiment, questionnaires on types of parenting were given to them. So statements like, I felt controlled and pressured in certain ways, and my dad avoids gay men whenever possible. And in the fourth experiment, there was a homophobia test, which included overt homophobia, which they judged by using a questionnaire on social policy and beliefs, and implicit homophobia, which they judged using a word completion exercise. So after all of that, they found that those with more supportive parents had an explicit sexual orientation that matched their implicit orientation. So, for instance, they openly identified to the researchers as a lesbian, for instance, and the test showed that their implicit desires were also lesbian. However, those from more authoritarian homes had the largest discrepancy between their explicit and implicit orientations, or the way they identified compared to their desires. Those who were explicitly heterosexual but implicitly gay were found to be more likely to react with hostility toward gay people. That incongruence was also able to protect many homophobic behaviors like endorsement of anti-gay policies and discriminatory bias against homosexuals. So it's a really interesting study. There are, of course, some problems. There are always problems. The study authors say that one big problem is that they only tested college kids, and in the future they would like to test adults who have had time to separate themselves from their parents, as well as adolescents who are still living with their parents. That's not the only problem, though. Others I've seen have expressed some concerns about the study. For the same reasons that I've seen people express concerns about any study that deals with homosexuality and particularly with desire. So it's extraordinarily difficult to differentiate between what sexuality people identify with, which you can ascertain by asking them, what people's actual behaviors are, their sexual behaviors, which you can ascertain by watching them, and then what their desires are. And this study primarily looked at their desires. And that's the hardest of the three to figure out because you can't just ask. So the question is, do these tests really get to the heart of what people really desire? And, you know, I'm sure the study authors would say yes, but me, I'm not a professional psychologist, but I'm not too convinced because maybe it's desire or maybe it's just interest or curiosity, like the second experiment. Choosing to look at pics of same-sex couples compared to choosing to look at pics of heterosexual couples, that doesn't necessarily mean you want to have sex with them. It just means you want to look at pictures of them.
And I agree. I mean, I was reading the study too. It's like that's a long chain of inference.
Yeah.
That's a lot of maybes getting and, to, therefore, they have more desire for homosexuality. You know, that really was the weak part of the study for me.
Yeah. I feel like to suggest that wanting to look at pictures of same-sex couples means that you won't identify with them sexually actually is in and of itself a bit close-minded and overly prudish, you know? So, you know, the other tests I think are a bit more conclusive, a bit more convincing, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
The first test of associating the words quickly, like I can, that makes more sense to me, but still it does, you know, if they believe that that second test is an accurate picture of what a person's desire is, then, you know, that does, for me, that calls into question the study. But I want to quickly mention that these findings match up pretty well with another study that just came out of Boston University. I think the press release just went out today. It was published in the Journal of Homosexuality. Researchers at BU surveyed more than 5,000 people in Massachusetts, and they found that gay and lesbian adults whose parents were not supportive of their orientation were 6 to 7 times more likely to suffer serious depression and engage in binge drinking. And they also found that the act of coming out of the closet resulted in significantly improved mental health, particularly in women. They didn't find the same effect in men, but the researchers say that might be an artifact in their study. So there are a couple of studies now that are coming out about parental influence on our behaviors, how we manifest our desires, and they're pretty much fitting in with our cliches, and, you know, they're fitting in with what we might guess to be true, what Freud, I guess, would support. This sort of idea of sublimating your desires only causes you misery. Not that Freud didn't say a whole lot of stupid shit, but, you know, it's worth noting that in that respect, that's something that we've certainly seen borne out. But whether or not this is just a fluke and a convenient sort of just-so story, I think it's going to take a lot more studies to determine.
Yeah, definitely. Anything this complex, you need to line up the ducks quite a bit. I mean, just one study like this, it's hard to get too excited about. It is all a little bit pop psychology, you know. But it does make sense as far as it goes in that traits that you fear in yourself, you will be highly critical of in other people. You know, so if you fear whatever the homosexuality in yourself because your parents are very judgmental about it, then you become hypercritical of the same thing, i.e. homophobic in other people. So, again, it seems to make sense from a pop psychology sort of perspective.
Right. I mean, if it were just a matter of a homophobic person simply not agreeing with someone being gay, that doesn't still explain why someone would go out of the way to actively, you know, campaign against homosexuality. In that respect, you know, the suggestion is that that person finds homosexuality actively threatening. And that is a really good explanation for why it might be threatening, because it challenges something that they, you know, that they themselves have been trying to sort of clamp down on due to their authoritarian upbringing. So, yeah, it fits what we sort of what we see, but, you know, whether or not it's solid, yeah, it's going to take a few more studies, I think.
Right. Yeah, all the more reason, as you say, to be skeptical of it, because it seems to make sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So we're really doing a lot of different kinds of items. We went from space to herbs to homophobia. Now, Evan, you're going to bring us around to toilet water.
I knew it.
And Bill Gates has something to do with this somehow.
I know, yeah, right? From the heights of the outer atmosphere to about as earthy a conversation as
right
you can probably have. Have you guys ever heard the phrase, the only two things certain in life are death and taxes?
Occasionally.
Of course.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that by suggesting the only things certain in life are death, taxes, and waste products. Mm-hmm. How about that? Now think about it.
It's catchy.
If you're living, I think it's true, though, because if you think about it, you're living, right? All things that are living, they'll create some level of biological waste, either in the form of a gas or a liquid or a solid or some combination of those, right?
Maybe even all at the same time.
Like even in debt. at the same time. And even in death, as you decompose, you're still spewing out, you know, these bodily waste products. So I know these are disgusting things to talk about. You know, these are things, though, that interest maybe Bob, perhaps more than the rest of us. And then there's nanotechnology.
Ooh.
Now, nanotechnology and nanoscience are the application and study of extremely small things. They're utilized across many, many scientific disciplines and fields, such as chemistry, biology, physics, material science, and engineering, amongst others. How small are we talking? Well, there are 25,400,000 nanometers in an inch. A sheet of newspaper is about 100,000 nanometers thick. And on a comparative scale, if a marble were a nanometer, then 1 meter would be the size of the Earth.
Wow.
Now, these are incredibly cool things to talk about. You know, things that interest Bob a bit more than perhaps the rest of us. So what happens when you combine the topics of biologic waste products and nanotechnology?
Oh,
one
boy.
Of two things, I suggest, has happened. You've either entered one of Bob's lucid dreams, or perhaps the more likely option is that you're trying to solve one of the world's grand-scale problems that has literally plagued humans for thousands of years, ever since their civilization and likely before that. We're talking about dysentery. So there's another old saying, which takes its wording from one of the more basic principles in the animal kingdom, and that is, you don't shit in the same place that you eat.
Yeah, don't crap where you eat.
Yeah, I try to follow that. Okay.
It's a really good principle to follow. It helps.
It's overrated.
But as the world's greatest producers of biological waste, we human beings are locked in an endless battle to keep our piss and crap out of our food and water. Now, dysentery occurs when pathogens such as viruses and bacteria, parasites, and other nasty bugs get into our digestive system. These little buggers get into our guts because sometimes in places around the world, like the third world countries, the water there is sometimes only available in contaminated form. The water's been contaminated. Sometimes that's the only water available. And millions of people around the world are sickened every year with dysentery, and in many cases, it's fatal. But thanks to nanoscientists such as Dr. Sarah Haig of the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom, we may one day see the end of this awful condition. She's come up with a rather ingenious idea. She is experimenting with a nanoscale scaffold device, right? A little lattice of sorts, which holds a mixture of bacteria and tiny metal nanoparticles. And the idea is that this will react with dirty wastewater, from toilets, for example, to extract useful hydrogen out of that dirty water, and then what's left over gets filtered once again, and the end product is clean water. You can filter out clean water through that. Dr. Haig's work has caught the attention of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And if we've talked about it on the show before about the foundation, it's one of the primary goals of the Gates Foundation is to eliminate poverty and impoverished conditions from the people in the world, in the poorest regions of the world. Dr. Haig and her colleagues were recently awarded a $100,000 research grant by the foundation, and they stand to receive a further $1 million from the Gates next year if they can demonstrate that the chemical reactions they propose can actually work. And I quote Dr. Haig when I say, "We plan to turn this essential everyday outgoing into an investment by developing novel materials that convert natural waste into a usable resource. This technology will be particularly important for remote locations in developing countries and will have the added benefits of reduced pollution and lower waste disposal costs."
It would also be very useful on space stations and on like moon bases and Mars bases if you have to recycle all your own waste.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, obviously the more immediate and pressing benefit would be, you know, lots of the world where they don't have safe drinking water. But, you know, you wonder, like, how acceptable this would be, you know. Or what if you knew that when you flushed your toilet, it went into a tank and came back out your kitchen sink?
I think people would get used to it.
Yeah, we've talked about this. I mean, there's the whole, like, it's too close. You know, you'd feel better if there was, like, a time period in between or more processes in between, you know.
Yeah. Wastewater does eventually get recycled. But it is a little close, yeah.
Yeah, a little close. But again, you have to compare it to nothing, right? I mean, better than nothing. in areas in which they have nothing to treat their water, deal with the waste products and so forth. So it can only help.
We get excited by, you know, a lot of like breakthroughs that are really sexy, but sometimes it's the simplest and most mundane and sometimes not very pleasant things that could actually have, you know, the hugest impact on quality of life and around the world. You know, something as simple as being able to clean wastewater, you know. Jay, quick update. You're going to give us a quick update on the Tennessee Monkey Bill, the bill in Tennessee to sneak creationism into public schools.
The unfortunate update is on April 10th, Governor Bill Haslam, who is the governor of Tennessee, allowed Tennessee's House Bill 368 to become law without his signature. And the bill is being called the Monkey Bill, as most of you know, because it promotes creationism in the classroom. So quick brief on it is, the law encourages teachers to present the scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of topics that come up in class, and they want to encourage the debate and disputation of things like biological evolution, chemical origins of life, global warming, and human cloning. The bill guarantees that the teachers won't be subject to any discipline for challenging the science of evolution and climate change. So the American Civil Liberties Union and the Americans United for Separation of Church and State asked Haslam to reject the bill, and that they maintain that it's unconstitutional and it's a method for teaching creationism and intelligent design in the school system. The governor said in a recent statement, "I have reviewed the final language of HB 368, SB 893, and assessed the legislation's impact. I have also evaluated the concerns that have been raised by the bill. I do not believe that this legislation changes the scientific standards that are taught in our schools or the curriculum that is used by our teachers. However, I also don't believe that it accomplishes anything that is already acceptable in our schools. The bill received strong bipartisan support, passing the House and Senate by a 3-to-1 margin, but good legislation should bring clarity and not confusion. My concern is that this bill has not met this objective. For that reason, I will not sign the bill, but will allow it to become law without my signature." Bullshit.
He said it's a crap law, but it's popular. So I'm going to let it pass without my signature.
Very convenient.
He's saying that we should legislate science, that science should be decided by public opinion, and that's wrong.
Eugenie Scott from the NCSE said, and I quote, "Telling students that evolution and climate change are scientifically controversial is miseducating them. Good science teachers know that. But the Tennessee legislature has now made it significantly harder to ensure that science is taught responsibly in the state's public schools." Very well said.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe there's a saving grace in that we've seen this happen and certain things have gotten passed in other states, and then the states later on have gone back and corrected it. I guess that's all we can really.
Well, they usually don't correct it. You know, lots of cases, the law gets thrown out, either in the state Supreme Court or in the federal Supreme Court. So this is not a second law that follows this format, the teaching the strengths and weaknesses sort of format as a way of providing cover for teachers who want to teach creationism. The first one was in Louisiana that was signed into law by Governor Jindal, who was more openly supportive of the law as opposed to the Tennessee governor. And that was in 2008. There has not been any legal challenges to that law so far, over 3 years. And it has had negative impact on the standards in the state. They have, you know, allowed teachers to introduce texts that are outside of the approved curriculum, for example, i.e. creationist texts. So it is having the exact negative impact that we feared that it would. The Tennessee law is a little bit different. It specifically prohibits going against the state science standards, So it's not as bad as the Louisiana law. One interesting point that Jeannie brought up when she was writing about it is that because it mentions things like global warming, that may not have the same constitutional problem that creationism does, right? Because it's not necessarily a religious issue. That may be harder to oppose legally than the evolution bit, because the opposing evolution, it's already so much legal precedent in this country to say that's a religious issue and therefore opposing it is – government intruding in religion and violates the First Amendment, that would not hold for some of the other issues like global warming.
And also another thing that I found earlier in the week, the Tennessee House approved a bill authorizing the display of the Ten Commandments in the public buildings as part of a display of, in quotes, historic documents.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. That's a very clever way of phrasing it. Yep.
Well, look on the bright side. Okay, this is called the monkey bill, obviously, because of the Scopes monkey trial, which was also in Tennessee, which was also a win for the creationists. And you know what? That didn't last.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, hopefully in time this will correct itself.
But seriously, I know you're joking, Rebecca, but seriously, we lost a generation who did not, you know, learn about evolution. And then, you know, it becomes self-perpetuating because then you have people who are ignorant of evolutionary theory and are easier to convince that there are scientific problems with evolution. So you get self-perpetuating ignorance. It's hard. It's a low energy state, you know.
Ignorance
is a low energy state, and it takes a lot, you know, constant vigilance and work to climb out of it. But you know, these kinds of things can be a huge setback.
The ignorance gravity well.
Yeah, exactly. All righty. Well, thanks, guys.
Who's that? Noisy. Who's that noisy?
Evan.
Doctor.
We're going to move on to Who's That Noisy. Are you ready?
I am ready. And we're going to start by playing for you last week's Who's That Noisy. Here we go.
Here's Oprah's hand. It's very interesting because the one thing that jumps out at me is that it's a working hand. There's a psychic ability here in a hand.
Psychic ability in that hand.
What a bunch of claptrap.
Claptrap.
Claptrap and horse hide.
What do we got?
Oh, boy. Well, we have a palm reader. Yep. Not just a palm reader. This palm reader has like a whole series of YouTube videos and other promotions and stuff that he does. And this guy is famous, well, famous, infamous, I should say, in his own right, for analyzing the palms of famous people such as Oprah Winfrey, Leonardo DiCaprio, Prince Harry, Kim Kardashian, Betty White, politician Herman Cain, Jennifer Lopez, Lady Gaga. Name it. You've heard of him or her. Yeah, that is a good shtick, isn't it? This guy's name is Tony Leggett, L-E-G-G-E-T. As he says in his own words, I was drafted into the army at age 18. When I was discharged, I got a job in a hardware store in London, which I hated. And one day, an elderly man came into the shop. He wore a scruffy raincoat, had long greasy hair, and said to me, cross my palm with silver, and I'll tell you your fortune.
Really?
I didn't have anything to lose, so I put 2 silver shillings into his hand. He looked at my palm and said, you will travel far away from here. You will live in a foreign country. You will become somewhat famous and be married by the age of 53. You'll journey around the world and meet many rich and famous people. Of course, I took it with a grain of salt. I was a skeptic. But he was only wrong about one thing. I got married a year earlier than he predicted. Everything else came to pass. And how did he know? And he went on to learn about palm reading from that moment on, and he began to practice it. In a nutshell, he could have also said, yes, I was duped by practically a cold reading technique when I was very young and very impressed by this, and it has forever warped my mind.
Yeah, and I realized I could make money doing the same thing.
Right, exactly.
It's a lot easier than working in a hardware store.
Did anybody get it?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple people. The first one to guess correctly from the message boards, Klintsvud. And I believe this is his second time that he's guessed correctly this year, if memory serves. So well done, Klintsvud, from the message board.
Good job. All right, well, what do you got for this week?
Here is the latest segment in our ongoing series of Who's That Noisy?
Check out the sound this makes.
A tinkling of some sort.
Yes. Well said, Steve. Well described.
Okay.
Who's That Tinkling?
That's a different game.
I don't think you said that right.
All right, folks, give us your best guess at that. info@theskepticsguide.org. Our forums are sguforums.com. Please join if you haven't already. And as I always say, good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. We have time for a couple quick emails this week. First, a correction. This one comes from George Dale Wellman from Sunderland, Massachusetts, and he writes, "Hi, skeptics, really enjoy the show, but as a computer science student, I just wanted to correct something Steve said in the explanation of one of the science fiction items from the show for April 7th. In the item about the quantum computer in a diamond, Steve said that the scientists tested it with an algorithm that finds an element in an unsorted database on the first try. I don't blame Steve, as it said this in the article too, but this is wrong. The algorithm used is called Grover's algorithm, and it was indeed, and it does indeed search an unsorted database much faster than a classical computer, but not in one step. As Steve said, with a database with n elements, a classical computer would take, on average, n over 2 steps to search it. Or, as we say in computer science, it has a time complexity of order n, represented by O, n in parentheses. Using Grover's algorithm,
makes perfect sense.
Yes.
Using Grover's algorithm, a quantum computer can search the database with a number of steps that is the square root of the number of elements in the database, which is much faster, but still not on the first try. Too bad you couldn't have Grip on for science or fiction. I'm sure he would have corrected this as well.
He would have rapped about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So the article I used as a source did say first try, and that is wrong.
Mine too, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that got propagated somehow through the press releases or whatever. But I did look up Grover's algorithm, and George is correct. It's the square root, which is still a lot faster. Let's say you have an unsorted database with a million items. You would have to look through, on average, half or 500,000 of them in using a conventional, say, computer algorithm to find the item you were looking for. With a quantum computer, you could do it in only 1,000 or the square root of 1,000,000. So that's a lot less. So yeah, not sure why the news items got that wrong, but I appreciate George correcting that. Another quick one. This one comes from Theron from Battle Mountain, Nevada.
It's a great town name.
Battle Mountain, yeah.
Battle Mountain.
He writes, OMG, what will young Earth creationists say? Then again, now the believers of Atlantis will be insufferable. And he gives a link announcing the discovery of a sunken city off the coast of India in Cambay, in the Gulf of Cambay. Mm-hmm. And guess how old this city is alleged to be?
1,000,000 years.
15,000 years old.
6,000 years old.
5 minutes.
9,000 years.
I was close.
That's wrong. The Earth was created 6,000 years ago.
Exactly.
Exactly.
That's and hence his comment about creationists. Unfortunately, this is total crap. This is not real science. This is pseudoscience. So this was 10 years ago. These runes were alleged to be discovered by there was a BBC article about this at the time. A great example of horrible science reporting. The scientists who were said to have discovered the ruins were variously described as oceanographers, as marine archaeologists. They weren't archaeologists, however. I don't know that there's any such thing as marine archaeologists. And if they were oceanographers, what do they know about sunken ruins? The evidence is pareidolia on, low-quality sonar. It's like really low-quality data. Then they claim that they found wood, and they carbon dated the wood to 9,000 years ago. A couple of problems with that. That part of the bay probably was of the Gulf probably was above water 9,000 years ago, but there were lots of trees there. So the finding wood doesn't necessarily mean that you found the remains of a human artifact. The alleged beads and pottery shards are probably just natural rocks and shells and stuff, not real artifacts. One individual that is involved with this project is Graham Hancock, and he is a famous pseudo-archaeologist.
I think we've talked about him
before. He's been promoting the Orion correlation hypothesis, the notion that the pyramids at Giza are arranged in the pattern of stars in Orion's belt and are therefore connected to that mythology. He wrote the quote-unquote nonfiction book Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. So he's one of these historical revisionists who thinks that there's an alternate, you know, history to mankind on the Earth involving aliens in some way.
Him and L. Ron Hubbard, yeah, they shared a room in college or something.
You know, also, it's been 10 years. You know, in 10 years, there hasn't been any verification of any component of the claims for this city. Now, of course, this would be a huge find because the oldest human city of any kind is only about 7,000 years old. So this would be a couple of thousand years older than that. Not that that's impossible, but you know that's a huge chunk of time to be pushing back the oldest city. And the oldest cities are not in this part of the world. At this time frame in India, people were living in villages, essentially. There was no culture building cities. The first real city in this part of the world dates back to only about 5,000 years. So this would be 4,000 years beyond that. That is pretty out of sync. Again, it wouldn't be impossible, you know, that there was some group of people who built the city and then they died out and, you know, it was lost to history and that we would just be discovering it now. Pretty extraordinary claim. Evidence pretty thin and nothing verified or legitimate. So interestingly, you know, with these kind of finds, politics often gets involved. You know, Indian politicians who are saying things like, oh yeah, those Western archaeologists have really been downplaying the role that India has played in the rise of human civilization. So now finally we have evidence to show that India is really the cradle of civilization. So whenever pseudo-archaeologists, like the Bosnian pyramids.
I was just about to say, that's exactly what that sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as soon as they say that they found something ancient and interesting anywhere, the local politicians love it because that's, you know, good for tourism, it's good for self-esteem and prestige, it's good for the culture, and the science kind of takes a back seat. You know, then if you're patriotic or whatever, you accept the claim because if it's good for your community and culture. Never mind the fact that it's pure pseudoscientific bunk. So I would be very surprised if the Cambay runes turn out to be anything. But at this point, there's no legitimate science behind it.
Too bad.
So the creationists can rest easy.
But they
won't.
This time. All right, guys. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. You guys ready to do some sniffing this week?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
All right, good. Here we go. Item number one. Scientists have created a power cell inside a living snail that can generate usable electricity from the snail's own energy stores. Item number two, a new study finds that fungal infections affecting the top five crops are responsible for destroying enough food to feed 600 million people every year. And item number three, a new survey finds that cancer patients prefer safe treatments with predictable outcomes to more risky but possibly more effective treatments. Jay, go first.
Steve, I'll happily go first. Okay, this first one about scientists creating a power cell that's inside of a living snail. And that can generate usable electricity from the snail's own energy stores, meaning that the snail's body has stored energy and it can use this generator to tap that energy and turn it into electricity. Wow. You know, first off, what kind of energy stores are we talking about? I mean, that's very interesting that they could do that. I'm sure that if this is true, that the snails have some twist to the way that they store energy. Something there that allows them to tap into it, which is really weird. That's interesting, but it's also very strange. Yeah, the second one about the fungal infections, and there's top five, and they're responsible for destroying enough food to feed 600 million people. That's very believable. I don't see any reason to doubt that. So I'm gonna just off the cuff say sure that one. It seems out of the three the most likely. Last one about cancer patients preferring the safer treatments. That makes sense too, but I have this feeling that, you know, there's a there's a curve here where the closer someone is getting to possibly dying or you know, be going into a point of no return, that they would become more and more likely to opt for the more dangerous but potentially more effective treatments. But it does make sense early on. You know, I know if I put myself in that position, I would want to go with the more proven, safe, but, you know, possibly less effective treatments than the more dangerous ones. I don't know. It's hard for me to say, I'm healthy right now, so I don't know what I'd really be thinking, but that seems like the likely one. So I guess out of the three of these, the one that seems the most full of baloney is the one about the snail. So I know that I can't pick that one because I'm going to do a Costanza again. I'm not going to pick the one my gut is telling me. The one that my gut believed the most was the one about the crops, so I'm going to pick that one.
The crops.
That's the fake. God damn it. And it's stupid.
Okay.
I could not follow that at all.
All right, Evan?
Can I go in reverse order?
Whatever order you like.
It's a survey that finds cancer patients prefer safer treatments with predictable outcomes. It's likely to be true. And here's why. Because people prefer safe treatments with predictable outcomes. There, I said it.
You're so risky, Evan.
Yes, I know. I took a big risk by saying that in itself. I just have a feeling that people, although there's plenty of wackiness out there, there's plenty of risky stuff, there's plenty of experimental stuff, there's stuff that seems too good to be true. I think when it comes down to it, when life is on the line, your life is on the line, and these are the most important decisions ever, people will tend to be a little bit more conservative. The second one, fungal infections affecting the top five crops responsible for destroying food. Well, I happen to think that this one's definitely science. I've been doing a little reading recently on this particular topic.
Whoa, don't hurt yourself.
I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm just saying that it just happened to come up recently, and therefore this is reinforcing my thoughts that this one is going to be science. So I have actually the most confidence that this one is science. The last one, this is the power cell inside the living snail that can generate usable electricity. Well, there's something science here, but I think we're either not getting the whole picture or there is, this is the one with a twist. If I could put my finger on the twist, I would. It's a little bit hard to do that. I couldn't say for sure why. I wonder why a snail as opposed to something else. I don't know how it would be able to generate enough electricity. Now, there are other animals out there that do generate electricity. We've got the electric eel. And I'm sure there are others that I'm not readily aware of. But so it's not like it's impossible. But I just don't know that they're probably on the path to doing it, but maybe have not yet made it this far. But tests are being done. So I'm going to say the snail one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Wow, another good one, Steve. I'll start with the first one, I guess. Yeah, I agree with Evan in that why a snail? I'm not sure why snail would be special and being able to generate electricity from energy stores. Yeah, that sounds a little bit beyond from what I thought we would be capable of. Why wouldn't they do a bigger animal? Yeah, I don't know about that one. The second one as well. I'm a little bit more confident about the second one. I'm not even sure that that crops get fungal infections. I just can't remember ever reading about that happening. Maybe that's the crux of this one and why it's wrong. But 600 million people, yeah, sounds like a lot, but it's, what is that, like a 14th of the population? So it's, you know, percentage-wise, it's not that huge, but it is a lot of people. And I could see that. I could definitely don't have any problems with that huge percentage of people that could potentially be fed, not being fed by these fungal infections that destroy crops. And the cancer patients went in. Initially, I thought this one was science, but now I'm kind of second guessing because it kind of strikes me as kind of like psychological pricing. You know, gas is $3.99 or just anything that's just a hair under the price that would make it seem like it's more. So I think when people hear about a treatment being potentially more effective, that's kind of like what sticks in their mind, and I could see them kind of going for, yeah, let's try that one. You know, I'll be the one that it'll work on. So that one kind of makes sense to me as well. Well, actually, I mean to say that one strikes me as fiction because I think I could see people opting for the riskier but potentially more effective treatment. So it's kind of between that and number one, the snail. Yeah, there's something wrong about that snail one as well. Ah, man, this is tough. Yeah, I'm gonna go with the cancer one. I think I could see people wanting to roll the dice and potentially have get a more effective treatment. I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, so Rebecca, we got a three-way tie.
Oh,
where are you
going to
put your nickel?
All right. Well, my thinking was about the snail. I don't think it necessarily has to generate the snail itself doesn't have to generate electricity. I don't think, as Evan suggested, it doesn't have to be like an electric eel. Like, my thinking was that it just needs to generate energy and usable electricity. Well, we've built things that require only very tiny little bits of electricity. So I can see how if you could get a tiny bit of electricity out of a snail, that would count. So that one didn't seem that far-fetched to me. It seemed cool. And this is definitely the first step on the way to the Matrix. But I like it. As to Bob wondering whether or not crops can get fungal infections, that I do know is a fact because I like bananas, and bananas are under a threat from very serious fungal infection. I don't think they're one of the top five crops, but that makes sense to me. Rice, wheat, I can see those things being at high risk for infection, particularly because of our farming practices, from what I understand, sometimes lend themselves to leaving crops open to infections and things. So let it be known that that makes a lot of sense to me too. Cancer patients preferring safe treatment. I think Bob makes a very good point on this one. I think that what I find most difficult about this is the fact that cancer is a large net, and it can, maybe you're talking about all kinds of cancer, but maybe you're talking about particularly deadly cancers. I can see that when faced with a poor prognosis, I can see someone being very willing to take a risk on something that, you know, decreases their chances of maybe surviving to X months, but increases their ultimate chances of living, you know, an extended period of time. So I think that's, I don't know, it's a complex issue, and I can see how maybe there are many cancer patients who would certainly opt for a riskier but less safe treatment. So I'm gonna go with that one as the fiction.
Okay, so I guess I can take this in order. Scientists have created a power cell inside a living snail that can generate usable electricity from the snail's own energy stores. Evan, you think this one is the fiction.
Yep.
The rest of you buy this one. And this one is science.
Yay.
Yeah, this one's
nah.
This one's cool.
I almost picked that one, Steve. I thought that you kind of were inspired by a news item I read about scientists implanting devices in a flying beetle. And I thought you kind of used that
as
inspiration.
No, this one was
a real-life
scientific tale of the first electrified snail. They have done this with cockroaches, rats, rabbits, and other animals previously implanted with biofuel cells. So this is implanting something in an animal to generate electricity using the sugars, the energy, you know, of the animal itself as the power source. So it's not a battery, it's a fuel cell. It generates the electricity enzymatically.
So you could use this to lose weight.
I guess so. They implant two different electrodes with different enzymes through the snail's shell, and one pulling electrons from glucose, the other using those electrons to turn oxygen molecules into water, and they induce an electric current. And Rebecca's right.
Cool.
It does not produce a lot of electricity, but this is sort of a proof of concept thing. Can you implant these kind of things to, say, operate a pacemaker or something that requires an ongoing source of a very small amount of electricity? Where, you know, making it from the energy inside the animal itself would be would be a good source. So that's what this is. This line of research is all about. But they successfully did it in a snail.
Cool.
Yeah, thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, sort of.
Yeah.
So as long as you're alive, it'll work.
Let's go on to number two. A new study finds that fungal infections affecting the top five crops are responsible for destroying enough food to feed 600 million people each year. Jay, you think this one is the fiction, correct? The rest of you think this one is science, and this one
is
science. Sorry, Jay.
Uh-huh. Yay. Damn you.
So, yeah, the top five crops are, what do you think?
Corn.
Rice.
Potato.
Wheat.
I think rice
marijuana.
Is number one, then corn, then wheat. Then
buckwheat.
Then I don't know what. Bananas.
It's not bananas. Rice, soybean, wheat, corn,
right.
And potatoes.
I said potatoes.
Yeah, so all staples. All staple crops. But it's fungus, really, more than anything else. Fungus, as a blight, wipes out $60 billion per year. That's actually in rice, wheat, and maize themselves, maize or corn, $60 billion per year. I thought of the banana thing too, Rebecca, although that's not in the top five. But and we talked about this previously, that you know, bananas are – there are lots of different species of bananas, not just the one that we think of as a dessert fruit. But their bananas are a staple food for a lot of parts of the world. And a lot of them – a lot of species are threatened by fungus. So fungus is a real growing problem for human agriculture. And we really need to figure out – how to make resistant crops, how to protect them from fungus, how to treat the fungus. It's, you know, like many things, we're engaged in an arms race, an evolutionary arms race against infectious organisms. Just, you know, you have that much food, which is all very, very similar, right? You have very little biodiversity within wheat, for example. That's an awfully tempting food source for anything that could figure out a way to exploit it.
Yeah, what I mentioned vaguely, what I was sort of getting at is that idea, and I've heard that people are trying to get back to proper crop rotation, but a lot of the problem is with poor education amongst, particularly in developing countries, with farmers. Convincing them to do it, teaching them how to do it is a huge obstacle.
Of course, they always warn about the worst case scenario, that if fungal infections get out of control, they can, you know, wipe out a significant amount of our global crops and even cause a global famine, leaving over 4.2 billion people starving. I don't know if they wiped out all of the top five crops, if that's what they're talking about, but yeah, it could be really bad. So let's go on to the last one. A new survey finds that cancer patients prefer safe treatments with predictable outcomes to more risky but possibly more effective treatments. Bob and Rebecca thought this one was the fiction, and this one is the fiction. And yeah, you can kind of go both ways with this. You can make the logic work either way, you know, safe and predictable, you know. So the actual choice that they gave patients in this study was, would you prefer, let's say you have a terminal cancer and you're offered treatment A, which will guaranteed you'll live 18 months, versus treatment B, where either you'll live for just a couple of months or maybe, if it works, 3 years. So,
right.
And the researchers were a little surprised that, you know, 70%+ of the people went for the nothing or 3 years, as opposed to the guaranteed 18 months. You know, you're right, Jay. It's kind of hard to put yourself into that mindset, you know, unless you're already facing a terminal illness.
See, I don't find that surprising at all. Like, that seems, I would probably do the same thing. That sounds perfectly logical.
I guess it does. I mean, I guess, are you more afraid of the it doesn't work and you die right away? Or are you hopeful for it might work? And they said 50-50. It's a 50-50 chance you either die right away or live 3 years, or 100% chance you live 18 months.
Here's where – this is the best way I can think of to describe the mindset that I'm imagining, is that you get the doctor tells you you're going to die in 18 months. And to me – if a doctor were to say that to me, that would be like, well, I'm dead. You know, that's it. That's my death sentence. I'm dead. So I'm going to spend the next 18 months, you know, watching the clock until I die.
Right.
So at that point, why not? You know, I'm already dead.
You feel like you have nothing to lose.
You know, and I'm sure that, right. Yeah. And of course, there are plenty of movies about people, you know, grabbing life by the balls and everything when they get a diagnosis like that. But I don't think that's necessarily what really happens. I think it's sometimes the opposite. Sometimes people feel like,
yeah,
you know, they might as well be dead.
The authors interpreted this result as indicating that there's a lot of power in hope, and that the value of the hope that the 50% chance of living for 3 years was felt to be worth it, worth the chance. So I guess it is, you know, hard to underestimate the value that hope can play. You know, we do see this with the offering of completely unscientific or unbelievable therapies, especially for terminal or chronic and severe illnesses, that, you know, people often say, what do I got to lose? I don't care. Yeah, it's magic. It's stupid. It probably is not going to work. But what do I have to lose? They play the lottery, basically, saying, yep, you know, maybe it's a small chance, but if I win, that's everything. You know, anything that will rescue them from the terminal diagnosis is worth the chance. This, of course, is why that's a vulnerable population, and why healthcare con artists and, you know, promoters of pseudoscientific treatments are so evil, in my opinion. You know, basically, they're just really exploiting people at their most vulnerable part of their lives. Often there is harm, you know, and they do have the stuff to lose. What little time they do have left, what quality of life they have left, you know, leaving their family destitute or deeply in debt for treatments that were of absolutely no value. You know, hope may be valuable, but I've also seen what happens when that hope comes crashing down. It's not pretty. You have to consider that as well. So, yeah, it's tricky. It's a very complicated situation. All right. Well, congratulations, Bob and Rebecca.
Yeah.
Thanks. And I'm kind of a low note, so it's not really appropriate to celebrate.
Well, Jay, give us a quote.
Yeah. Too late. I have a really cool quote this week. This is a quote sent in by a listener who labeled him or herself as GM Prospect. This quote is from a video game. I'll say the quote, and I'll ask you guys to guess the video game. One sure mark of a fool is to dismiss anything outside his experience as being impossible.
Donkey Kong.
Kessel von Wolfenstein.
Skyrim.
It's from Skyrim.
I win.
That was said by a character in the game called Varengar's Sacred Fire.
And his orchestra.
Steve, I have a couple of announcements. This first announcement is that there is a great regional conference in Southern California on May 19th and 20th called the Orange County Freethought Alliance Conference. And this conference is going to be at the University of California, Irvine in the Conference Center. Some of the secular leaders speaking are Michael Shermer, Brian Dunning, Mr. Deity, Barbara Forrest, Robert Price, Dan Barker, Phil Zuckerman, and Richard Carrier. And you can see all those speakers at freethoughtalliance.org. And Rebecca, now you went to this conference last year.
Yeah, I spoke at it last year.
The second announcement, it's not really an announcement, it's a request. Anybody that works at Panasonic or has a friend or family member that works at Panasonic, contact me. info@theskepticsguide.org.
What is this?
I need help.
You want a new stereo?
No, it's very important. It's very important, but I'm not going to say why. I just need... I need to know if anyone has anybody that works there that can give me a hookup. That's all I'm going to say.
You are abusing this show, sir.
No, I am not, because this is for the SGU. It is absolutely for the Skeptics Guide.
I'd like to know if anybody works for Cadbury. Please get in touch with me immediately. It's very important.
Anyone work at the Federal Reserve? I could...
Are you done? And Jay, we should mention that
nope.
Some of our listeners have started sgutranscripts.org, and they're actually engaging in the very Herculean task of writing transcripts for all SGU episodes. I think they've gotten two done, with the latest two episodes.
I'd like to give the transcript folks here's a hint. There's five O's in hello.
Yeah, so this is definitely a wiki project. This is the kind of thing where the faster it'll go. So thanks for working on that, guys. And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you,
thanks, Steve.
Hey,
good night.
Good to be.
Be good.
Next week we will be at Nexus. I hope a lot of you will be joining us. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.